Welcome back, everyone, to the Damage Report. Today is Wednesday. It is JR Wednesday, and so here's JR.
It is JR Wednesday. Fun times, pretty good.
It's actually
not fun times. We're doing a lot of devastating things mm-hmm. in the news today.
I mean, do you think that we're ever going to start the show fun times and just mean it? Well, we hope maybe
that's like a good approach, you know, go with the positive. Mm-hmm. You know, we have Happy Half Hour with Brett Ehrlich, mm-hmm. nice little plug. And
we do.
We could start with something like that every once in a while.
That's true.
Despite the devastation of America.
That's true.
We can go with fun.
I'm still hopeful. Look, I'm hoping someday to have to change the name of the show. But for right now, we still got some work to do. And what do we have to work on? Well, impeachment is one thing. We're going to be giving you updates on that. Later on the show, though, we've got a couple clips from Fox News. So gird yourself for that, because Rudy Giuliani, turns out Rudy Giuliani confident, kind of crazier than Rudy Giuliani panicked. So we're going to show you videos of him kind of like in a groove, and it's bonkers still. And then the new messaging around whistleblowers, what are the right calling them? You're gonna find that fascinating. And then we've got updates on Bernie Sanders' campaign. How has the recent health difficulties, how is that going to affect him going forward? Elizabeth Warren responds to criticism that she's been facing and makes a major change in terms of how she's fundraising for her campaign. And then there's this community meeting about homelessness in New York that goes way wrong, way fast. So we're gonna have that for you too, but we're gonna be starting off.
I guess spoiler alert, it doesn't just happen in New York.
Yeah.
I'll tell you.
Okay, so we're gonna talk about that, but let's start with impeachment. You know what, that's sort of a big story, understandably so. Donald Trump's strategy on impeachment was fairly clear yesterday when he blocked the testimony of Sondland, who could have talked a little bit about the text messages that were incredibly damning. And it was formalized later in the day though. So to give you an idea, a little spoiler on what the strategy going forward is, here's Steve Doocy.
I don't think they had it until yesterday. It is minimum cooperation, maximum confrontation.
Okay, so that is the most astute analysis Steve Doocy's ever had. He can just, you know, coast by for the rest of the year. So minimum cooperation, maximum confrontation, which is also, that's what they've always done. It's not new or anything, but the form is new. It comes in letter form. So they delivered this letter to the investigators in the House, effectively declaring that, no, we're not gonna do any of this. So I wanna read you some excerpts. Here's one section I liked. Never before in our history has the House of Representatives, under the control of either political party, taken the American people down the dangerous path you seem determined to pursue. So we've done this before.
Say, which dangerous,
and the last time was the Republicans.
Yeah, which dangerous path are we talking about? The dangerous path of impeachment that we've never heard of before? Or are we talking about allowing a corrupt and and wild-eyed president to continue to do whatever he wants in office? Which one of those things is the dangerous path? By the way, we have allowed a corrupt and dangerous president to do things before, just saying.
Yeah, many times, I would argue. Yeah, I would argue that's more dangerous. They're trying to pitch impeachment, which they were literally the last party to pursue, not based off of, you know, trying to sell out our elections to foreign powers for your own personal gain, but over oral sex. So I understand it is different. I would argue that oral sex less dangerous, depending on your dental health, less dangerous in general. But this is their communications right now. So let's give you a little bit more. Put simply, this is an excerpt from the letter. Put simply, you seek to overturn the results of the 2016 election and deprive the American people of the president they have freely chosen. Many Democrats now apparently view impeachment not only as a means to undo the Democratic results of the last election, but as a strategy to influence the next election, which is barely more than a year away. Now, lest you believe that from that last bit that they would not have had a problem with this if it had been instituted earlier, I kind of doubt it. But this is to basically sway two elections. So in 2016, the American people freely chose Donald Trump, which is one way to spin what happened. We're gonna ignore 2018, literally everyone ignores 2018. Nobody talks about it on the right or on the left really. Mm-hmm. Like he got destroyed, the Republicans got destroyed, and everybody's just like, what name so? It doesn't look like anything to
me. What about talk of mandate? People elected this Congress to do something about this rogue president for everything he keeps putting out there. So whenever you, no matter what the time frame is, the talking point will always conform to it for Republicans. So if this happened early in the presidency, they'd be like, look at them trying to overturn the 2016 election with this impeachment talk right away. Or after 18, after some of the Democrats came in and said, we're gonna come in and impeach the MFR. They're like, okay, now it's after the midterms. You guys are trying to go half halfway through this presidency to overturn 2016. Now that it's late in his first term, he'd be like, you guys are trying to go and change the 2020 election because it's late in the first term. So no matter what it is, they can always find a way to say, you guys are doing this at the wrong time. Because you know when the wrong time is? Any time for them.
Yeah, yeah. You can't talk about changing the Electoral College near an election, certainly. And right now, boring. We should talk about that now. There's never the right time to do something they just don't want you to do.
Yeah, there is a right time for Mitch McConnell to say, when President Obama's in office, I'm gonna do everything I can to make sure this president has absolutely nothing, can get no judges confirmed, can get nothing passed through the Senate because I'm in charge of it. That's okay. He can also say, it's been my only idea to make sure that this is a one-term president. How about you do your job?
Yeah. Yeah, and look, it comes down to not the timing and not the partisanship, but the validity of the accusation. So I was doing a live video earlier today, and someone said, couldn't Obama have faced impeachment over effectively authorizing, effectively, the assassination of two US citizens abroad with a drone strike? Yeah, potentially. Yeah, that's the sort of thing that they could have pursued. But that wasn't what the Republicans were pursuing. Look, they were mostly just bothered by his skin color, honestly. But they would pretend that it was fiscal this and whatever that. And by the way, quick update, we'll jump back to this. But Donald Trump, during the campaign, trying to appeal to the Tea Party, which remember, was not a racial thing. It was about deficits. Said, I'm going to eliminate the national debt in 8 years. And the deficits have gone up so far in 2 years by 68%, I think. Man, the Tea Party will not stop talking about how much they've been betrayed. It's weird. They just keep on talking about it.
Well, they stop talking because they stop getting paid.
Exactly. Okay, so I want to give you a little bit more from the letter. JR, I want you to evaluate on a scale from 1 to 10, how attached to reality is this paragraph? For his part, President Trump took the unprecedented step of providing the public transparency by declassifying and releasing the record of his call with President Zelensky of Ukraine. The record clearly established that the call was completely appropriate and that there is no basis for your inquiry.
What's the point? I mean, so again, so I'm not sure if we'll get to this, but we had like a few Republican congressmen came forward, Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan, Gates, all of them came out and had this firing squad of anger yelling, and Lee Zeldin yelling at the cameras and the reporters about everything that was going on. So they're angry and they're talking about how you're trying to subvert everything that's happening and you should release what Volker said in testimony last week before we have Sondland come on. But every time something is released, from the Mueller report to then the not transcript, but the memo of the call that you decided to put out, no matter what it is, you will spin it a different way. We saw what happened with the Department of Justice when they got their hands on the Mueller report before anyone else got their hands on it. So releasing more things doesn't mean anything different. So in this case, he released that call that was completely appropriate and there's no basis for your inquiry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Based in nothing, just because they're saying it, and then that's the fact. It doesn't make any sense. So who cares what you release? You're gonna spin it the wrong way.
Yeah, yeah, and we're supposed to pretend that because some of them are congressmen and some of them are senators, Mitch McConnell's a senator, we cloak them in the aura of they were elected democratically, and thus they have this authority and responsibility and all that. Yeah, they were elected democratically and they have no interest in American democracy. They have no commitment to our Constitution. They don't believe in checks and balances. They are not in the legislature to provide a check on the president, regardless of whether the president is a Democrat or a Republican, as Congress is supposed to do. They're there to obfuscate for the president, their leader, their king, effectively. They are perfectly fine with that. Not all elected Republicans are. Most of them are just cowards hiding in the shadows and not being willing to stand up against him. But some are coming out enthusiastically in support of an American emperor. That's what they're doing. Now, they go forward with another paragraph. We can flash it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But they end with, for all of these blah blahs, President Trump and his administration cannot participate in your partisan and unconstitutional inquiry under these circumstances, which was summed up very well on Colbert last night with it's a courtroom. He's like, do you plead, are you guilty or innocent? What's your plea? And he's like, pass. No, you don't, it still goes on though. You can't just not participate. Like, you can obstruct justice and thus commit more impeachable offenses, but you can't just step out. It doesn't just go away if you're not there. We're not looking for like branches of government quorum here.
The worst thing that this president has done to the Republican Party is expose just how susceptible they have been, always have been apparently, at least in recent history, to a dictator, to a strongman, to someone who will subvert every part of democracy that they say they love and hold dear and say makes America so much more exceptional than everywhere else. So foreign countries can look at this and go, wow, This was easier than we could ever have imagined. We didn't even have to do anything. They just elected a crazy person that a certain percentage of elected officials will follow no matter what, and literally say, I'm not sure if we're getting to Joe DeNova.
We will later on,
DeNova, but they love kings. Mm-hmm. They want one now.
That's a great
somehow
point.
America has become that.
We're gonna have that later on, yeah. Yeah, we have made some fatal errors. We have assumed that our democratic institutions are stronger than they are. We have assumed that our norms are anything other than paper thin protections against an authoritarian. We've assumed that every American agrees, not on everything, not on the issues, but agrees on representative democracy. And we've been wrong on all of those things. That is simply not true. We're supposed to pretend that it is. It's like a happy thing to pretend that we would never be like all of these other democracies that have fallen to fascism and other forms of authoritarianism. That could never happen here, but it can happen here. People are trying to make it happen here now. The only question is, are we going to be stronger than those who want to overthrow our system of government? Okay, so we're taking a short break right now. When we come back, really interesting information, potentially bad for Joe Biden after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic. Or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
If you think about crack houses on the one hand and raves on the other, you might think that there's not much sort of logically connecting those two things. But when it comes to the law, both in the past and in the present, they have been linked by some opportunistic politicians. And joining us now to break this down and talk about the human cost of what we're going to be talking about is Zachary Siegel, writer for The Appeal. Zachary, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. You wrote an awesome article for The Appeal about this and how this issue relates to Joe Biden, who of course is a fairly prominent politician in our current political context. So tell us about the crack house statue and what connection it has to raves, past and present.
Okay, so it's a bit of a non-linear path. It begins in 1986 when Joe Biden and arch segregationist Strom Thurmond pass a arcane provision to the Controlled Substances Act called the crack house statute. And the moral panic of the day were crack houses, where you have these big houses in urban areas where the landlord would take money from people who were just sort of squatting in the building for the sole purposes of using crack. And in drug dealing operations, these landlords were not being prosecuted. So they wanted to target people sort of higher in the chain. And that's how the crack house statute came to be. And then years later, they tried to apply this statute to a rave promoter named Disco Donnie. And I talked to him extensively for the piece that I wrote about how he, you know, became in the crosshairs of the DEA for throwing parties at the State Palace Theater in New Orleans. These were raves, and of course, people did MDMA at these raves. And so they tried to apply the Krakow statute to him simply for throwing a party.
And so you can sort of see here that this, I'm speaking to the audience here, that this law is being used to target an ever widening range of behaviors that weren't specifically targeted initially. And that might seem like, oh, just sort of natural drift, but you have some quotes in there from Joe Biden that make it clear that's sort of by design, the idea that it seems specific, but that it could be applied more broadly.
Yes, this statute is incredibly vague. It's basically like if you own a house or your name is on the lease of any agreement and drugs are being done in that space, you could be criminally indicted. And this has caused a lot of issues, especially in the festival scene where people, promoters throwing festivals, they want to provide harm reduction services, like, you know, people can test their drugs to make sure that they're not adulterated, or give out water, provide a cool down space so people don't overheat. Even providing these services could violate the statute. So it's had a really dangerous legacy in the rave scene.
And it looks like from your article that it both has the legacy. I mean, you talk about it sort of starting literally decades ago, but that even in the present, it's apparently being used to block a Philadelphia-based nonprofit called Safe House, a supervised injection site.
That's right. So now, come 2019, this statute, this law, it just won't go away. And so Safe House, as you said, they're trying to open up a supervised injection site in Philadelphia. And some context there, Philadelphia has seen astronomical rates of drug overdose deaths. And a supervised injection site could meaningfully reduce that number. And so these sites operate all over Canada and Western Europe. They have pretty positive outcomes for the communities in which they operate. And the second that the federal government got wind that this group called Safe House wanted to open one of these facilities in Philadelphia, well, they said that this violates the Krakow statute because they would be owning a building that would, quote unquote, facilitate the use of illicit drugs.
Okay, and so you talk about how this basically began in part through the authorship of Joe Biden. Is this something that in more recent years he's talked about? Is he still supportive or enthusiastic about this law? Or is that just something from his past?
That's a really good question. So back in May, I wrote a piece for Politico basically about his drug policy legacy. And I sent questions to the campaign about this Krakow statute, about the 1986 law, and wondered, you know, where he stands on this. And they didn't provide any specifics. They didn't say whether he disagreed with it or not anymore, or whether he would do anything to sort of change it. And then for this most recent piece in The Appeal, I again sent the same questions to the campaign, and this time they just didn't even respond. So it's a mystery. I mean, I would hope that as a front runner, he would come out and talk about this issue because it's connected to the opioid overdose crisis, which is the deadliest drug overdose crisis in recorded history, and any president is going to have to deal with this.
That's a great point, and that makes it seem like this should be a natural question at one of our upcoming debates. We'll see if it ends up being one. Zachary Siegel, writer for The Appeal, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I want to take a short break here. When we come back, Fox News continues to try to keep pace with the president's defense in this impeachment inquiry. We'll have the latest when we come back. Rudy Giuliani's media tour in defense of Donald Trump as this impeachment inquiry gets going continues, and it hasn't always worked out for him. He often says things that are sort of demonstrably untrue, but we have a case here where he is incredibly specifically wrong, even supernaturally wrong. Let's take a look.
You told me you're looking at possibly preparing a lawsuit against Adam Schiff. You said in the very least a civil suit because he's been caught in this lie. His team did have access to some accounts from the whistleblower.
He's got one big mouth, boy. And he relies on the speech and debate clause. But tell him to read Hutchinson against Proxmire. The speech and debate clause only protects him in that little chamber when he goes on television on MSNBC or the corrupt news network. We can use all that against him. And how about this, Trish? The Salem witch trials required people to testify against you and face your accuser and face the accused. These guys want to conduct a secret proceeding so we never find out who the accusers are so we can test their credibility. Are they Americans? That happened in the Soviet Union.
So you want more transparency,
Lindsey
Graham?
Where's the New York Times? Civil liberties.
Lindsey Graham is offering
friends.
It. Are you going to take them up?
It is outrageous. Even Joe McCarthy didn't do this.
Many a time I find myself yelling to the heavens, civil liberties. So this impeachment inquiry is horrible. It's worse than the Salem witch trials, because at least there you had to face your accuser. But did you? I did a little bit of research into this. So people were spreading this around online. Turns out there was a kind of evidence used in the Salem witch trials that you might not be familiar with. So here's what it is. It's called spectral evidence. It was testimony that the accused witch's spirit appeared to the witness in a dream or vision, maybe as a black cat or a wolf. The dream or vision was admitted as evidence in official court proceedings. Thus, witnesses who were often the accusers of the witch would testify that Goody Proctor bit, pinched, and almost choked me, and it would be taken as evidence that the accused was responsible for the biting, pinching, and choking, even though they were elsewhere at the time. So you could literally say a ghost told me they did it, and that would be accepted as evidence. But that's what he uses to contrast with this witch hunt, which we're experiencing.
He's
right
banking
now
on the fact that people will have no idea what happened with the Salem witch trials.
He doesn't care, obviously.
It doesn't matter, because then you can look up the history and be like, how does this have anything to do? It's just trigger words. He went with McCarthy, Salem witch trials. There was another a big trigger word that people have to hear and go, oh man, this is horrible.
All I heard was yappa, yappa, yappa.
Yeah, oh man, he's got a big mouth, boy. So it's so weird. So when you actually, again, Salem witch trials were in 1600, 1692, for a year, by the way, 1692 to 1693, because this war went on that pushed a lot of people, refugees, again, we've been dealing with refugees since forever, down to this area, which it was a strain on the small community. And they were like, there's too many refugees here. We need to come up with a way to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Let's call them witches. That's the same thing as what's happening here with this president in 2019, breaking the law and subverting the Constitution for his own personal use and gain for the next election. That has anything to do with what's happening right now?
Yeah.
1692, before we even had all this whole establishment of the country? Really?
Yeah, the thing is that Giuliani is, you know, he's smart enough, I guess, to have a successful life for the most part. But he's not as clever as he thinks he is. So he hears Trump call this a witch trial, and he goes way too literal with it. He wants to compare it to actual witch trials, which again, were not things where witches were coming after you. It was a trial of a witch. They really don't seem to get that. And he throws out the McCarthyism because that term has been stripped of literally all of its meaning over the past few years. But what I love about this is, the Salem witch trials are a cautionary tale about a country that demonizes women and doesn't trust anything that they say. Their testimony is worth nothing. It's literally worth less than a ghost's testimony. And here you have an investigation, totally constitutional, of a president who himself has apparently assaulted, stalked, harassed dozens of women. Today, we find out about 43 more women. And the country responds by demonizing those women, not listening to what they say, saying their testimony doesn't count. So we've really evolved a lot over the past 400 or so years.
It's depressing.
It is.
But he's gonna go up there and keep laughing and looking up and going, oh yeah, it's gonna happen, boy. It's so weird, but I honestly, you know what, man? I don't think enough people, they can't be buying this. They can't be. Every time he goes on TV, there's no way supporters of the president look at Rudy Giuliani and go, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a guy who's got it all together. That's a guy who's a legal mind, who's putting this all together in a right way. Nobody thinks that.
The host smiled because she sees he's, like I said in the intro to the show, that like usually he's like crazy because he's panicked. Here he's crazy because he's confident. That's why he's like, oh, he's got a big problem, boy. I don't know, what are you, Joe Biden in the 70s? What are you talking about? Why are you talking like that? But that's because He's deranged, literally. I mean that literally. He is off his rocker. He's literally not sitting in a rocker there. He should be. He should be rocking somewhere in retirement. But to your point about whether this is working on his base, that I don't necessarily know. But I can look at the polls, and the numbers have gone up significantly in favor of impeachment in just less than 2 weeks. One poll had the support amongst Republicans going up by like 20 points, which means it's at about 20 points. It's still like nothing, but it's going up amongst impeachment and Democrats as well. And so that seems significant. Okay, let's move to something that might even be a little bit weirder. The terminology that's being used to demonize whistleblowers themselves. We're gonna turn now to another Fox News host. So whistleblowers being talked about quite a bit on Fox these days. Joe DiGenova, I think this is how you pronounce it, a big supporter of the president. He was on with Laura Ingraham, and take a look at how he's attempting to establish a new term that we should use to refer to these whistleblowers.
What you're seeing is regicide. This is regicide by another name, fake impeachment. The Democrats in the House want to destroy the president. They don't want to preserve the republic. There's nothing honorable about what is happening. We get first one anonymous informant, then a second anonymous informant. I refuse to call them whistleblowers. These two non-entities are suicide bombers that the Democrats have unleashed on the democratic process. It's pretty obvious that this first suicide bomber who sent that complaint to the inspector general was a paid Democratic operative of the Democratic Party.
Political suicide bomber, obviously,
yes.
Before we start getting people messages. He really meant suicide. Get a sense of humor, okay? If you still think that, then you really should. You watch another show where we have to spell it all out for you.
You just did spell it out. And when I want humor, I go to Laura Ingraham, Joe, and Rudy Giuliani. It's basically like they cloned Gaffigan a few times. But anyway, what I love is he rolls it out. They're basically suicide bombers. And then 20 seconds later, it's just the suicide bomber that sent a complaint to him. They just use it as a term now.
Just start using it because, you know, we're going to continue with that funny term because, again,
he was laughing. Yeah. You could see the smile on his face as he joked. It was his routine, his bit.
We keep talking about how these defenses of these unconstitutional folks, every time they come forward and finally go over the top and someone goes, whoa, I think that kind of rhetoric, I don't think we can go with. Let's call it a joke. How many times do they call things that are very serious a joke? And then by very crazy people who follow them to the ends of the earth will be like, yeah, suicide bombers, we got to go after them. They don't take it as a joke. The people that come and murder folks over it, or who send mail bombs to news organizations, They don't think it's a joke. But then once that all comes forward, you're like, I was just joking. How'd you guys not catch my joke? I wasn't really calling them suicide bombers and regicide.
Yep.
Did you have an explanation of regicide before I get into this?
So regicide is literally murdering the king.
Murdering the who?
The king.
The king.
Yeah.
Which king? The king of America? That king that we've got? Again, we're regressing back to this. Somehow we talk about this freedom we have. Oh, man, we stomped Britain back in the day, man. We gained our independence from that rogue king.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime someone kills a king, it's probably because he was probably decimating and destroying the citizens because he's doing everything for his own benefit and wealth and worth.
Yeah.
We're now backing that up now. We've got the Department of Justice that is arguing against allowing Mueller's testimony that was redacted before because there was a precedent set when Nixon was going through the Watergate issues. And they said that was done incorrectly back in the day. We're relitigating Nixon. Mm-hmm. We're calling President Trump a king because that's what we'd rather have. Next, we're gonna start validating Hitler.
Yeah.
How many horrible people in history are we gonna say they were actually on the right side of before they lost?
They are going to destroy everything on his way out, assuming that he does get taken out.
No, like you have to pay attention to this. You got to pay attention to the cues. We keep talking about this. We got kings, we've got Nixon. Next up is Hitler, and everybody likes to use Hitler whenever they're attacking political opponents. But maybe I'll bring up the bad guys they've already supported.
Yeah.
We're going to be okay with this?
Yeah, and is it a coincidence that in his two jokes, both of them involve trying to scare Fox News viewers into thinking that there was a mortal threat to either themselves or someone they support? So the whistleblowers aren't people who are concerned about what they see. And again, I've said this a million times, I'll continue to say it. If they disappeared today, he's already admitted to it in written form and on TV, but I digress. So they're suicide bombers, and they're not trying to remove Trump from office, they're trying to murder him. Your king or whatever, the person you support, they're trying to kill them. It's really insult to injury against the left, because the right are the ones who actually do political violence, and then they spit in your face by saying that you're the ones who are politically violent. So that's a convenient little trick that they've set up. But I don't know how often Joe DiGenova is on there. I would assume every night. This is going to spread. We are like 2 hours from Donald Trump calling the whistleblower a suicide bomber on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of these segments are auditions for Trump tweets. That's all that they are. It's trying to trot something out. And maybe if it goes a little bit too far, like the Daily Wire guy who was attacking Greta Thunberg, he's banned now.
Yeah.
That didn't make it to a tweet. They attacked her in different ways on Trump's Twitter. But if this is successful, then this is going to be the official line. Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan, all of them are going to be rolling it out from now on.
Well, Laura Ingraham was trying to save DiGenova right there by saying it's a joke, because, oh man, if he follows through on this, calling folks suicide bombers, American citizens who have whistleblower protections, calling them suicide bombers, that might get him cut off the way that last guy did, because he wasn't challenged on air, or at least didn't go with the, oh, you're just joking, right? When you talking about this climate change activist that's a terrorist somehow.
Exactly. Okay, so that's Fox News. We're going to take a short break. We come back, want to update you on the status of two of the Democratic primary contenders. Bernie Sanders obviously had some health problems. How is he doing? What are his plans for his campaign? And Elizabeth Warren has a pretty major announcement after this. Bernie Sanders is now up and about in the initial recovery period after his heart troubles that he was in the hospital for just a few days ago. He's already been putting out new plans, his big campaign finance plan, his anti-corruption plan. So he's been active. But in terms of how active he's going to be in terms of events, he has been asked about that. And here's what he said.
Look, we were doing, you know, in some cases, 5 or 6 meetings a day, you know, 3 or 4 rallies and town meetings, and meeting with groups of people. I don't think I'm going to do that. But I certainly intend to be actively campaigning. I think we're going to change the nature of the campaign a bit, make sure that I have the strength to do what I have to do.
What do you mean by change the nature?
Well, probably not doing 4 rallies a day. I'm not quite sure that I could be wrong on this, but I don't know there's anybody who did more rallies than we have done all over the state. So we're going to, you know, probably not do 3 or 4 rallies a day, do 2 or do other events as well.
So that is Bernie Sanders responding fairly impromptu, I think. He was probably approached by some journalist in a sober, serious way about a concern that some people have. And he was incredibly honest and forthright about it. And so he must be destroyed. So look, I have a feeling how this is going to be spun. I have one example of it in just a second. But let's take it on the merits. Right. He's going to be shifting his campaign strategy a little bit. He had been campaigning pretty hard for anyone, for someone half his age. And so I don't know that it's necessarily the worst thing in the world, but I liked that pace too. And so it's not great news necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I always wonder the degree to which you can do these things and how much they help, like on a grand scale, to do 4 rallies a day, because I didn't know that was the pace that they were going at. And how much it really transfers into votes, right? Because it's 2019, again, I keep saying it this way. It seems odd to me when I've seen people run and they have to go and knock on doors, literally. I was like, man, people still literally walk down the street and knock on doors? Is there a paperboy riding down with a paperboy hat on and throwing papers? It seems archaic to me that you can get your message out still without going and literally knocking on doors, without literally having 4 rallies a day in one state. It seems odd. So I think it's, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I've never run for office before. To slow down your pace and still be effective in getting your message out, because there's multiple ways of doing it now.
Yeah, I mean, I think at his level, he doesn't have to do the knocking on doors, but like AOC, that was one of the big things she did, was she knocked on every door she possibly could. I think that he's relatively insulated from this affecting him more so than a lot of politicians, because he's a known quantity. People know who he is. They're familiar with him. He doesn't have to do as much work to get his name out. He does have to make the case against other candidates, and rallies can help him to do that. They can help to sustain the movement and all of that. But he's a savvy politician with a lot of experience. And so if anyone can come up with alternative ways to do that, he's probably well positioned to do that. Now, how is this going to be received by people who are not trying to be reasonable? Well, I have an example of one. Someone who is in a very particular area of their own career, quite reasonable, but then once they venture off of those safe shores,
they delve into bias. This is Nate Silver, noted numbers guy, who says, I sort of wonder if this means that he's entering a phase where his goal is to pull the nominee to the left and or to build a movement rather than to actually win. Arguably, that's been his de facto goal from the start, although maybe not consciously so. I mean, you only get 280 characters on a tweet to pack it so full of condescension. That is difficult. So Bernie Sanders, that dummy, he doesn't even know that he wasn't really trying to become president. He's faking it even to himself. All he's doing is trying to influence things. And by the way, it is a great trick to avoid any acknowledgement of the fact that he has pulled the country and the party to the left, and then say he's just trying to pull the party to the left. He hasn't accomplished a titanic act to change people's views on some of the biggest, most important policy proposals in decades in American political history. Ignore that, doesn't matter, we've all caught up there. Now he's just running to pull them to the left.
When it comes to health of older candidates and even people in office, I don't know, I kind of wish we as Americans would maybe think of it differently. So if someone is running for office and then they potentially have some kind of health issues, like physical health issues, I get if it's a mental health issue, because maybe they'll make decisions that aren't based in much reality. We're dealing with that right now.
Yeah.
But when it comes to physical health issues, if someone's running for office and they haven't even gotten there yet, but they're coming up with plans that will actually help Americans, and then you go, well, he's too old, because then what would happen, right? Maybe they'll, like, okay, John McCain passed away last year, right? He died when he was still in office. Did the world turn upside down? Did Arizona sink into the desert? Like, I don't understand what it means happens if a politician has physical health issues, but they have plans that'll actually help people. So if they're running for office and they're talking all this stuff and they go, all that sounds great, but you have this heart condition, so therefore none of that means anything. Why is that our perception? Yeah, why is that our assumption?
If you think that they're not they've declined mentally to the point where they can't keep up with the job, I think that that is a valid concern. Now we have to be fair about it. We can't be conspiratorial about it. But just in terms of like, I don't think he could do an Iron Man anymore, so I'm not going to vote for him. That seems a little bit
what
weird.
What does that have to do with it? You have to have meetings and come up with plans and have a staff around you. It just seems odd, and I think we need to get beyond it. Dick Cheney has a iron heart right now, but he still carried out a lot of atrosities when he was in office.
Yeah, so he's
you can still do your horrible work.
He's steam powered. He is a steampunk. That is what he is, and yet he managed to do it. So anyway, that's an update on Bernie Sanders. Obviously, you know, best wishes to him during his recovery. So really fast update on another candidate. I'm gonna jump to Elizabeth Warren here. Elizabeth Warren has been criticized, I think rightly, for some of what she said about campaign finance. Now, throughout this primary, aside from a percentage of some of the money that she had transferred from her past Senate run, she's been doing a great job of raising money from regular people, small donors. Now, the average donation is higher than Bernie Sanders, and she hasn't had as many individual donors as Bernie Sanders, but compared to basically everyone else in the race, she's been doing an incredibly good job. But looking ahead to the general election, she had left room and been fairly clear about the fact that avoiding the big dollar fundraisers was not something that was going to last into the general election. And so I think people were rightfully like, well, like, what is it? Is that money good or is it bad? Like, it should be consistent. And so she's faced a lot of criticism for that. And now she is actually, she's changing on it. So whereas before she said things like, I do not believe in unilateral disarmament, she's now moved to, as of today, I will not be forced to make changes in how I raise money. Look, for me, this is pretty straightforward. Either you think democracy works and electing a president is all about going behind closed doors with bazillionaires and corporate executives and lobbyists and scooping up as much money as possible, or you think it's about a grassroots, let's build this from the ground up. So after her initial response, CBS's Zach Kudak asked if that was Ms. Warren's position, no matter how much money Donald Trump is raising, and she said, yeah. I'm not going to do the big dollar fundraisers. I'm just not going to do it. The whole notion behind this campaign is that we can build this together, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, a lot of people are talking about the back and forth that you had with it. So the whole point of calling out someone's previous statements that are probably troubling is to see if they have some kind of change of heart or if they still believe it. We have this problem with Joe Biden. Every time something came up with things that he's done in the past, he sticks by it and says, yeah, that was messed up then, but I'm still doing it now. And we go, okay, that's a problem, because now that you're running for president in 2020, if you're still holding on to things you did in 1986, that's going to be a problem, because it's not 1986 and we're not dealing with those policies. We're not going to deal with that anymore. So if Elizabeth Warren had issues with her fundraising and now she's changed over and said we're going to do something differently, let's go ahead and go with it. Yeah. Why are we still harping on that? We want to change. That's the point of calling someone out.
Yeah, and look, I think it's 100% reasonable to say, okay, even so,
Bernie Sanders has been more consistent on it, both in the past, up until recently.
Right.
100%, that's totally valid. Mm-hmm. And you have to watch her. But I don't think that she's asking you to just trust her or whatever. Like, you can look at the recent evidence during the campaign, aside from what we've already cited, that she has been raising it in the way that we would want. And now we can watch. If she goes back on her word, then we'll respond to it then. There's no need to react to this in sort of a knee-jerk fashion. You can take a victory when you get a victory. If we put pressure and she is moving in the right direction, even against all of the advice she's getting from lots of pundits and everybody, like, people are reacting to this in the sort of mainstream media as the worst thing she could possibly do. Like, if she's the nominee, this is it, she's going to lose. But she's still doing it anyway, so that's not nothing. Doesn't mean you have to trust her. Trust is irrelevant. Trust but verify.
Yeah, just wait and see. That's all. I mean, again, it's if you don't want to believe it, that's fine. But at least go with it. Don't say, hey, I want to have some answers. You get the answers and go, yeah, but that's not what you said before.
Yeah,
but you ask for answers now.
Yeah, I want people to move in the right direction. Although, again, Bernie Sanders has still been better on it. Anyway, we're gonna take one last break. We come back, it's gonna get a little bit dark. Just in the last few days, New York, which obviously, like many parts of the US, has a big homelessness problem, had a community meeting about the establishment of an upcoming homeless shelter, and it didn't go in the direction we might wish.
I do not care about homeless. I feel sorry, but I don't want them in my backyard. They are ticking bomb. They are ticking bomb.
Hey.
I don't want to feel threatened every night I come home. My little granddaughter school right next to it. I'm not happy. I'm extremely unhappy. I hope somebody's gonna burn the place down. If that's gonna happen, I don't care.
So there, obviously a fired up community member saying that she hopes that the homeless shelter, when it's set up, will be burned to the ground. Now, for context, understand that this hearing came just days after four homeless men were bludgeoned to death in Chinatown. This is just last weekend. So we know that homeless individuals across the country are already targeted for violence and murder. It is an epidemic that rarely gets talked about. And so to have at this hearing someone get cheers when she says that someone should burn down this structure, theoretically with people inside of it, that's
pretty
dark.
This hearing it went that way for the whole time. They even had to stop it after just over an hour into because so many angry people were so upset about this potential homeless shelter being built in their community. Now, I understand your concerns, whatever's going on. I'm on that Nextdoor app. Everyone in certain communities knows this. And this kind of anger happens everywhere. Because there's tents are popping up all over the place under overpasses and on community streets, things like that. And people are getting upset and they always post about this on those. And then these arguments happen and people would say the same thing that lady was saying. Get them out of my community. They're breaking into my house. They're doing this, they're doing that. And someone says, you know, statistically, they're being murdered at a higher rate than anyone else. And a lot of times whenever these crimes happen, it's not always just because they're out there to get you because there's nowhere else for them to go. Whatever addiction issues happen, whatever mental health issues are happening with them, and we're just thinking, send them off. Send them off where? And by
anywhere.
What authority?
Not in my backyard.
Yeah, that sidewalk on that main street is not your property. So I get that it's an eyesore. I get that you don't like having to walk past people. I get you don't like watching people at freeway exits asking for money. Chill out.
Yeah.
Is the bottom line. So it's this. This is seems like it was a New York issue, but it's a nationwide issue. But no one wants to see the source of the problem. They just want to push it to the next person.
Yeah, and like so, de Blasio says that he wants to set up 90 new homeless shelters and expand 30. They're buildings, so they do have to be somewhere. And the idea is that, you know, obviously this is going to help people. That is often ignored in this sort of thing, that these are people who have had, you know, medical bankruptcies or whatever. Something terrible has happened to them. Nobody's choosing to do this. So it will greatly benefit them, but also help to solve the problem that everybody thinks is a problem. But again, nobody wants to be solved in a way that they still have to see. So they don't want to see the tents. They're also not willing to have a building to not see the tents. It has to go somewhere.
They're also not willing to have any of the community money go to making sure that they're not in the situations that end up putting them on the streets either.
Exactly.
Like, if your money's going to go to any kind of things to help them from getting there, you're not doing that with my money.
Yeah.
So they're going to end up right there.
And by the way, in this particular structure, not that it matters because it doesn't matter. To qualify to stay there, you have to qualify by having a job. These are people who are working but still currently living on the streets.
Yeah.
That want to go. These are people who are trying to put their lives back together and unfortunately getting pushed out. And so, big problem in LA too. God knows what's gonna happen when we start having our community meetings.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you as always. Great to have you on.
I feel like I yelled a lot today.
So. You know what? Sometimes the news makes you yell. Anyway, thank you everybody for watching. It's been great to have you on. We still got a couple more days in the week. Big plans, including Brett Ehrlich, who's going to join us on Friday. More guests, lots to get to. And so thank you so much for watching. And we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.